Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
Oh, it's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Well, we're back, Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. We have Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 11. NASDAQ Futures up 76 after the huge update yesterday after the somewhat benign CPI report. Probably had something also to do with the final start of the ceasefire over in Middle East, although that didn't seem to get any press, although I got to believe that was part of the news as well. It's very difficult to try and figure out when you have these days up, down, or flat as to why exactly that happened, because there's all kinds of variables in the world, but one man who's not a variable is Professor Liu. Is he with us?
I am, and that ceasefire deal has already cratered.
Well, that didn't take long.
Yeah, I actually had to I got up on one of my midnight trips and checked Twitter, and it's on the news now. It's in the mainstream news now. But apparently Hamas changed the terms when they came to try to sign the thing this morning or before the Israeli cabinet met. Hamas negotiators apparently said, we want some more concessions from Israel. Last minute deal, and at this time I'm going off of Israeli sources here, and Netanyahu said, instructed the negotiators to walk out, and then said, we're not making any more changes. Either you sign what you agreed to or the deal's off. I'm not going to submit it to
who's
the
cabinet. Actually negotiating for Hamas?
Pardon me?
Who's actually negotiating for Hamas?
They've gotten a negotiation team that they've had in Qatar for some time. I don't know. I mean, it was never the leadership. So I don't know who their negotiators are. But in any event, the Israelis have said that they're not altering the terms of the deal that they agreed to yesterday. And in the meantime, before the deal was supposed to take effect 24 hours or 48 hours after it was signed. In the meantime, the Israelis hit some conclave or gathering of fighters in Gaza, killed a bunch of people yesterday, and right now I think the whole thing's likely to fall apart. I'm sort of torn personally on it. I think it's a terrible deal, but I also understand that a significant portion of the Israeli population just says, we don't care. We've killed a bunch of them. It's time. Get our people back.
It's kind of where I'm at on the deal, but
well, there's a huge. You know, there's a huge cultural thing in the Israeli population that's driven in part by some prescription in the Old Testament about not allowing or retrieving hostages, people who have been captured in battle, as soon as possible. And Netanyahu has been able to, and his administration, I think he's much more hardened, but he's been able to resist the incredible push from, you know, the Israeli families of these hostages to do anything to get their people back, and I think he's finally at a point where His military is telling him, look, we can, you know, we need to move to another phase here, or we're going to be an occupying force, or we can continue to mop these people up, but we're not going to get these people back unless we make concessions. So maybe it's time. And so what I don't understand is the release of, you know, 1,000 Palestinians held in jail. I don't understand that part of it. If
maybe they were gathered up like the people at Guantanamo and didn't do anything.
Well, the leverage, I mean, they're in jail. They're in jail because they committed criminal offenses. They weren't just arrested for nothing. They are in jail for criminal offenses, including murder and terrorism and a bunch of other stuff. And if I'm, you know, that's how this whole thing really got its genesis, the attack of October 7th, because the guy that organized it and the one that was killed later in Gaza, Sinwar, had been held in an Israeli prison and was swapped out as part of a prisoner exchange for, I believe, the body of an Israeli soldier that had been captured. So there are some really interesting implications here. So let me give you
like,
an example.
It sounds like a book or something needs to be.
Well, yeah. Let me give you an example of how bad this could be. And I don't know what the Israeli negotiators, I'm sure they've thought of this, but I don't know if it's been in a specific term. So a number, you know, I don't know, they think probably 100, roughly 100 people might be left alive or might be still there. They don't know how many are left alive. But, you know, a number of those captives, you know, 24 or so at least, were young women. And in released video, you can hear the captors from around October 7 pointing to these women and saying, these can become pregnant. So let me just postulate a horrific scenario where these women have been raped and are pregnant and have delivered in the interim, have delivered babies.
Mm-hmm.
That the Palestinians now say, well, we told you we'd give up the prisoners, but not their children. You know, that is
somebody want anybody else's 1-year-old, for God's sake?
Well, that is, oh, are you kidding? As a spoil of war?
Oh, man.
Something they could parade through the streets of Gaza and say, look.
If you dropped the 1-year-old on me, I'd say, hey, it's yours, not mine.
Yeah, well, you don't look at it this way, because it's not a child. It's a forced mating of, you know, an Arab with an Israeli woman, and this child would be something, it would be another negotiating.
Last time I checked, aren't we in the 21st century? It sounds like the Romans, you know, the rape of the Sabines. I remember reading that when I was in high school.
Yeah, and this is why, you know, this is why our sensitivities and sensibilities are a distinct disadvantage in fighting a culture like this. So the minute the hostage deal was announced, there were 10,000 people in the streets of Gaza. Some of them with guns, shooting them in the air, screaming, we've won, we've won, we'll now go to Jerusalem and, you know, provide millions of martyrs. I mean, this is not a rational, you know, art of the deal kind of culture. They want one thing.
A real lot of them, Lou, have to just want this to be over and live a life.
Yeah, well, when I say they, I mean the collective majority of the people in that area, the Gazans, want nothing more than the total destruction of Israel and the murder of every Jew.
Well, there isn't. There can't be anybody there who hasn't lost a brother, father, or somebody to this last 2 years.
Well, and you would think that they would start to wizen up after
that
a while.
That would be one emotion. The other would be, you know, unrivaled indemnity, like the Hatfields, and like the Irish and the Brits.
I mean, you know, Israel's in the same position.
Yep.
And so, but Israel is not interested in murdering every last Gazan.
There would be some that would argue with that, but I'm with you.
I mean, if they were, there may be some Israelis who feel that way, but as a matter of public policy, if the Israelis were interested in that, they would have done it.
They're up to quite a few.
They're certainly capable of doing it, but they've been very. You don't have any idea what they could rain down on that place.
I understand. I mean, I understand, but I felt the same way about Rumsfeld. I tried not to hit those guys. How hard you try?
Well, I mean, you know, we follow the tenets of international law. We tried not to. We warned them. We dropped leaflets. We told them where we were going to hit, and you know, the people that stayed there.
Well, whatever. Well, I was happy it was over. Now I'm unhappy it's not. I guess what can I say?
Well, you know, I mean, the guy. We've had this discussion. The guy's responsible for every civilian death in Gaza. Is Hamas. They use them. They use their population as a civilian shield, and they like it that way. And so that, I mean, you have Hamas officials saying our goal is to get a number of our people, so many of our people killed that the international community will attack Israel.
I think we've also learned over long periods of time, even bombing cities in Germany after the war was essentially over, I think rational people have figured out that killing the innocents because somehow or another they're not throwing the bad guys out, bad guys are not going to get thrown out by their own people.
Well, I'm not, I mean, the short answer is, This is not a war of two major armies. This is a war of, you know, civilian hostages and what we just described.
Yep.
With, you know, rape and everything else. I'm in any event.
Where do those guys get that? Do they have any kind of religion? Where do they figure that that's okay?
What, rape?
Well, yeah. I mean,
there are tenets of Islam. I mean. So I don't know if you followed what happened when ISIS got formed.
But what I'm saying is for a long period of time, people used the Bible to go knock off other countries, but that was 1,000 years ago. These guys are a little bit behind.
This is part of their religious culture. If you followed what happened when ISIS was formed, you had a number of clerics, Islamic clerics, in England and other places, appearing on YouTube, telling people to join ISIS, and one of the benefits was that the Quran allows you to have sex slaves, and that's a great deal for you. And we are capturing women and turning them, they will become your sex slaves as a matter of religious doctrine.
Are you sure that's in there?
Well, I'm not a Quranic scholar. So I haven't read the actual verse, but you can find, you know, I don't know, a dozen.
I
want to
know whose translation. It's got to be somebody's translation with some horny dude or something.
Well, but that's a huge aspect of martyrdom, Tom.
No, I don't know.
Is these guys going?
That's
right. Going to, and you get, you know, you, it, it, it's perverse.
But to get somebody to believe it is kind of even more bizarre.
It's medieval. Well, again, coming out, if you're in that, you're immersed in that culture, you don't know what else to believe. So anyway, my point is this. I'm torn about this. I want the killing to stop. There are too many, there've been a lot of people killed there, but you know, I understand why, but I still think it needs to stop. And I want the Israelis to be satisfied with the end result.
So do I.
But at the same time, I think a deal that requires them to do anything other than stop killing Hamas is crazy. In other words, you release the hostages and we'll stop killing you. How's that? Since you started this, you release the hostages and we'll stop bombing.
Well, that would seem to be the right deal for me, too. I mean, it's...
Yeah. And rather than, okay, we'll give you back 1,000 of your people, we'll replenish your ranks, and we'll allow... I would be, if I were the Israelis, you know, and I mean, they may not be able to do this on an international scale, I would say, here's the deal. You know, you release the hostages, or we're going to turn off the food spigot. We're going to stop those trucks from entering Gaza, and you can sort out among yourselves.
Well, then you're making the assumption that the people you're starving have some sort of a power over the people that are, because they're going to still be eaten.
The short answer is, you know, they can go solve the problem. It's not, you know, not my circus, not my monkey. you know, you guys can deal with that yourselves. We're gonna act like an occupying power. If you don't release those people, then we are going to cut off food supplies, and you can sort it out. But they're not going to do that. They won't do that. It would be a public relations issue.
Is there any chance when this is over? God knows it's got to be over someday. Is there any chance that this could become some sort of a regular place? I mean, Yasser Arafat wasn't this kind of a goofball, was he?
Yes, he was.
He was out.
Ask Bill Clinton.
I understand that part. Well, I sort of understand that part. I mean, Bill Clinton told him, "I could have been a great man except for you," but I didn't see him running around chasing young women.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, he was a little more polished about it. But his followers were
the same. Absolutely. Right. I thought he was
bloodthirsty medieval types. Could it become a regular place? Yes, I think it could. It could become Beirut.
Is there anything there? Is there any kind of agriculture? Is there any kind of? There's not a port, which makes it a problem.
They could make a port. It's fantastic beaches. They had some development there for tourism. It could become Beirut with the fantastic beaches and infrastructure and hotels and the whole bit. It could become an agricultural area. The Israelis, when we were living there, they had a bunch of settlers who had lived there, had put in hydroponic gardens that were producing mega amounts of vegetables and fruit and produce. By the way, had the Gazans not torn all that up the minute the Israelis evacuated and destroyed all of it, they could probably be self-sufficient in terms of produce. But in any event, the possibility is there, but I think you have to end up where Golda Meir, predicted one or said some time ago. We will have peace with the Gazans, when they love, life more than they love killing Jews, and we're not there yet.
The people in the West Bank, is that totally different?
Not really. Hamas is not in the West Bank. It's the Palestinian Authority, but the Palestinian Authority is constantly being supplanted by Israeli defense forces and Israeli security forces to try to deal with issues that it can't deal with. That there's just a larger Israeli presence right there.
Well, at the end of the day, in the last 2 years, I know nobody's ever going to give any kind of kudos to the current administration, even if it is their fault or whatever. Has what's happened there in Gaza, what's happened in Hezbollah, and what's happened to the Houthis, and what these guys just did in Syria, is Iran half denuded?
Yes. Well, Iran is greatly limited now in terms of the influence that it has in the area, which is another reason I think the Israelis ought to just work on, like, Hegseth and some other people have said, that the president's national security, Trump's national security advisor, have said, which is basically we may have to kill every single member of Hamas, and that's a desirable goal. But yes, Iran is greatly limited in that area. Now, I'm sure the Iranians are trying to figure out ways to exploit what's happening in Syria right now. I don't know what the Syrian regime is doing. The Iranians,
well, out of the gate, though, they didn't look like they were Iran flunkies, did they?
Well, no, and you got to remember that the guys that are in charge, if I get my tribes right, the guys that are in charge in Syria right now are Sunni Muslims, radical Sunni Muslims, and the people in charge in Iran are Shiite. And don't mix.
Is there any where one of the sides, Sunni versus Shia, one of the sides is more, God, I don't know what term to use, more 20th century Western, or are they both sort of radical?
I would say the Iranians are they integrate with the 20th century. They just have no interest in it. Their goal is the destruction of Israel and the establishment of a Shia caliphate. The guys that took over in Syria are also fundamentalist Muslims. You know, they're an offshoot of ISIS. Now they've kept things in check so far, but I read one Middle East scholar who said that the main difference between the guys taking over in Syria and the Islamic State people is that the guys taking over Syria are allowed to play soccer by their clerics.
There you go.
Yeah. So the short answer is we are dealing with, at least in Syria and in Gaza, a culture that is back in the Middle Ages. You know,
how do the Saudis fit into this? They're all Sunni?
The Saudis are Sunni, yeah. There are elements in Saudi culture, that's where Al-Qaeda comes from, that were, you know, had a Salafist is the sect within that religion, and that's a group that was responsible for the development of Al-Qaeda. So they've got a strong fundamentalist Islamic bent, but they've liberalized gradually over the last generation. And Bin Salman, the Saudi leader, is generally seen to be, I won't say a moderate, but somebody who's trying to do a better job of integrating his culture into the Western world.
But the only place that actually got very westernized was Iran under the Shah.
Iran under the Shah. Iraq had more religious freedom than Saudi Arabia, you know, when Saddam Hussein was there. The Qataris, the Kuwaitis, the Omanis, these people have all, they haven't given up on Islam, but they don't embrace the kind of Islamic fundamentalism that causes them to say we have to make war on our neighbors. I mean, Oman, I was in Oman. The Omanis have a very, what I would consider to be thoughtful kind of view of Islam as a way of regulating your life and you know, maintaining balance that I found, you know, I thought it was very attractive. I talked to a couple of Omani officers when we were there, and I wasn't there for that long, but I was able to talk to them about you know, the differences. And you know, they made a point, and the Houthis, by the way, at that stage were active in Yemen but hadn't gotten territory, and they made a point of telling me, look, we're not like the guys in Yemen, the he referred to them as the fanatics. Our Islamic variant, and you know, and they still had a sultan. I think they still do as the head of their state. He said our sultan is a very open, you know, minded kind of guy who is mainly looks at the Quran as guidance on how to make the country better and how to make it himself better.
Well, the group that is, there's a lot of Islamic people out in the southwest burbs now, and that's about as peaceful a group as you can find. The only complaint, Lou, is Audrey's selling his house, and these people are complaining because there's a mosque down the block, so people are always coming and going, right? So I said, okay, it's okay to live across the Catholic Church because they're only here 4 hours a week. And the guy goes, "You got it."
Okay, well, they go to mass. They've got most Catholic churches have daily mass.
Yeah, there's not very many people there.
But there's not, you know,
not three times a day or whatever those guys.
Not three times a day. Yeah. So, I don't. In any event, this is going to be what's happened in Gaza is I'm afraid going to be intractable, unless. Because these folks are not motivated, and we've had this discussion too.
The Israelis got to be getting tired of doing this too.
They are tired of doing it. That's why they were desperate to get rid of management of that area and turn it over to the Gazans and say, here, we'll walk away. You can have the hydroponic farms. You can have the infrastructure we've put in place. You can have all of it. It's cost you nothing. We are walking away. Good luck to you. And then, you know,
just don't bother us,
the rocket started.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, it's...
We're going to do a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit. I want to ask you a few questions as Attorney Lou. We got all kinds of things to talk. Plus, I want to talk to you about the sports and stuff, because there are a million questions about who exactly the people are that are making all the marketing deals. Don't call them agents for all these people. SP Futures up 7, NASDAQ Futures up 68. We'll have a quick go to break. We come back. We'll talk about all the happy totals from yesterday. Everybody made money. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks. Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right
now. Right now. Low and low Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 775. NASDAQ Futures up 69. Dow Futures actually down 85. But I don't see McDonald's down 230. I've got... Well, there it is. United Healthcare is down $18, so that's one of the reasons there. But I wouldn't worry too much about that. This is a celebration of yesterday. Dow up 703, S&P up 107, NASDAQ up 466, that's 2.5%. Yes, good day for all the clients, good day for everybody. What could go wrong with a bull market? A DAX up 51.2%, FTSE up 46.5%, CAC around up 151, that's 2%. Wow. Richemont, whoever that is, up 17% on quarterly results, boosting luxury sector. That must be on the French exchange. I don't say that any of our clients have Richemont. I guess they wish they did. Over in Asia, Nikkei up 128.3%, Hang Seng up 236, 1.2%. Shanghai up 8.3%. Hang Seng trying to make an assault on 20,000, 19,522 bonds. Up 3 basis points, 4.68. They were down pretty... 10-year was down pretty heavy yesterday after the CPI number came out, but now it looks like we're creeping back up here a little bit. The Bund up 3 basis points, 2.55. Japan down 4, 1.21. We have the... yeah, I gotta screw this up. No, I didn't. Oil. Down 77 cents, but 79.27. Long way out of the range, the 67 to 72.5 range we were in for quite a while. Now it's... I'm going to say it broke out of that range. We'll get Greg to confirm that. He's our futures dude. But I'm saying $7 up, it's broken out, Greg. Just saying. Brent down 76 cents, 81.27. Natural gas up 4 cents, 4.12 as it continues to be cold in the Midwest and Northeast. RBOB down a penny, 2.13. Gold up $11, 27.25. I think that 27.28. Silver up 17 cents, 31.71. Copper up a penny, 4.40. So all my people that are long gold and gold miners and stuff... Yesterday, everybody was happy. There was nobody sad. Yesterday was a good day. U.S. dollar against the euro, 102.7, which again is down. a little bit. The British pound, 121.9. That's about unchanged. We've got Bitcoin down 539 at 99,368. So pretty much everybody made some dough yesterday, unless you were just flat out short, but we weren't. So, Greg, what do you have for us? Traffic, weather, sports. I hope you weren't short spoo, Greg.
No, negative, Ghost Rider. Right. It is 6:37 here in Chicago. We have 23 degrees right now, high of 36 today, so significantly warmer.
Enjoy
than it's
it.
Going to be cold again this weekend, though. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news. Phoenix, 49 right now, high of 74 today, sunny all day. Tonight, probably a low of 45. Traffic inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 12 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook, 26 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 21 minutes. The Ryan from 95th is 21 minutes also. And Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 24 minutes. NHL, Hawks lose to the Flames. Oh, no. That was yesterday. Hold on. I'll get back to you on that.
Bulls lost last night again.
Yeah, Bulls lose.
They're horrible. They are horrible.
To the Hawks. That was 110-94. And then we've got NCAA basketball, Big Ten. Number 12, Michigan wins at home against Penn State. That was 90-85. And number 17, Purdue wins at Washington, 69-58. So I got Chief. Back to you guys.
Well, I don't want to dig too deep into this, but I have a somewhat of a question from a. I know you're one of the more. You're a conservative dude. That doesn't make you bad, makes you good. But you also have somewhat of an open mind about things, more than somewhat. How long are we going to go with this poor Donald crap? And everybody, yesterday I was mentioned on the show that the SEC had sued Elon Musk regarding didn't disclosing his Twitter ownership on time. The blowback I got from everybody was like a tsunami. It's that SEC. It's that Biden's SEC. Lou, this has been a rule that's been around and been obeyed by just about everybody for the 45 years I've been in the business. Now, how long do all the people around Trump get a dispensation from any rule because of the bad things did to this poor Donald? How long is this going to go? This is the simplest rule on earth. If you buy 5%, if you buy 5% of a stock, you got to let people know what your intentions are. He didn't do it.
It's going to go for a while.
How screwed up is this? Why does this guy get a dispensation?
But okay, so let's think back. This is a guy who a outgoing president of the United States and his vice president a sitting president of the United States and his vice president orchestrated a coup attempt by falsely setting up a judicial investigation and weaponizing the Department of Justice and the intelligence agencies to go after him and his people to hamstring him.
And he was never guilty of anything. Never guilty
of anything. By falsely alleging that he was a Russian agent or and under the influence of Russia. So that's a start. You then have a series of phony impeachments that were put together, rushed through in violation of their normal practice by the Democratic House. You then have a series of
He was never guilty of anything anywhere. He didn't pay hush money into any of those things.
I'm just saying, but the point that I want to make is he's had, 15, 20 separate legal things initiated against him cobbled together.
Lou, I've been record 100 times saying,
you gotta let me finish.
Yeah, but I'm saying, about Trump or about Musk. I didn't ask you about Trump.
I'm talking about Trump.
I'm asking you about Musk.
But this is when you do this as a matter of practice, and when I say you, I mean the federal government, I mean Joe Biden's Department of Justice, and all of the regulatory agencies that pay fealty to him, when you set this up so that this happens, you have poisoned the well now for any kind of viable, legitimate prosecution.
The question was, how
long? It's going to be a while. Because we know, for example, that there is a significant percentage of federal agencies and the people who occupy them who have already pledged to do anything they can to stop the effective implementation of programs and policies under the Trump administration.
Actually, the discussion we're having is exactly the question I asked you. And as my most logical person I think I have on the show. Well, I have all kinds of people. Everybody's pretty darn good. Everybody, or else, in fact, I think our group is pretty damn good, to be honest with you. But my question is, but you just did it. I asked, here's a guy who has a serious history with the SEC. By the way, most of his history with the SEC, I think, was during the Trump administration, right? When he said he was going to take his own stock back in, and then he didn't and everything, and he was muzzled for a while. I mean, my question is, here's a man that doesn't believe that any rule applies to him, Musk. I honestly believe that. And I've been rescued 100 times. As you know, I'm no fan of Trump's, but I don't think anybody in this country, even him, should be driven through what you just described to the tune where the guy has $80 million or whatever his illegal bills. That should never happen in this country. So yeah. I'm with you on that.
Let me get then. I don't know whether, I mean, if Musk did not disclose this and the SEC regularly prosecutes this, I don't have a problem with it. I will say this.
I don't think they prosecute it because everybody pays attention to it.
Everybody knows it.
That's the number.
One of the things that jumped out of the Biden administration's lawfare program was selective prosecution. So you have Donald, for example, you have Trump being prosecuted for those documents down in Florida when they knew that Biden had taken stuff for decades and nobody did anything. And Hillary Clinton, destroyed her server so that she wouldn't get caught with all the classified stuff she had on there. So
you'll never get me to defend Hillary or Biden.
My point is, I'm not trying to get you to defend them. My point is that they weren't prosecuted, but Trump was. So the selective prosecution issue has been a theme with Musk and Musk's properties ever since. And this is, it's all timing based. This is something that arose when he began criticizing the government and when he took over Twitter. And when
this arose when he said he was going to take his own company private. The stock ran up 50 bucks. The next day he said, I was just kidding, and it ran down again. You can't do that. That was during the Trump administration.
I get that. And so to the extent that he's guilty of that, fine. Fine him. Do your thing. But we have a history of this Department of Justice, SEC, the NLRB, the EEOC, all of these federal agencies have a history of selective prosecution against Trump supporters. And this is the problem. They have so damaged their credibility with the conduct over the last 10 years that when you say how long are people going to be making excuses for him, it's going to be a while.
Well, it might not just be just a Musk question. Louis, I mean, I started in the 80s, for God's sake. There were takeovers all the time. I never saw anybody who didn't realize that this was a real rule. I've heard some rumors that Warren Buffett got let slide a couple times. But I don't know. Those are just rumors in the mist.
I saw that story, and my immediate reaction was, well, my first reaction was, have they prosecuted anybody else for this lately that was guilty of it, or that looked like they had done something wrong? That was my first reaction. My second reaction was, this could well be more lawfare, but we don't know, and that's why
way over 5%. I think the man's personality is he doesn't, no rules apply to him.
Well, I can't agree or disagree because I don't know him. But I do know that his agencies have been, or his companies have been, subjected to some fairly ridiculous prosecutions by federal executive agencies, and that I think are ridiculous. But that's neither here nor there. It I don't know about this particular instance. I'm one of these guys that says, okay, each separate trial, each separate whatever stands by itself. If he's guilty, fine him.
This is one, Lou, you don't. This goes to somebody's mentality. If I know, it's like driving 75 and a 40 and saying you're an alderman, you can't be pulled
Tom,
over.
Tom, everybody Elon knows. Musk had a $55 billion compensation package taken away from him by some idiotic judge in Delaware because she thought, because he was an ally of Donald Trump. A package that was voted not once but twice by the shareholders. A package that, when it was originally put in place, pretty much everybody in your industry said, "This is ridiculous. He'll never make this. He'll never get that money. Why would he agree to such a ridiculous package?" And yet he did. And so, you know, if a legal system had cost me $55 billion. That I had properly earned and that had been voted by my shareholders and paid some law firm $354 million in legal fees.
What do you say, you and I take a show?
I would be saying to myself, I think the system's rigged against me, and so the rules that it's applying to me are bogus.
I'm going to say that board is rigged against a fair deal because he picks them all. Every board's like that now. We should have a whole show on that.
Nobody in their right mind thought that he would make that money. They thought it was a huge risk on his part to accept a compensation package that was that far-fetched.
Lou, he's got $55 billion, and the shareholders have never gotten a dime.
I'm sorry, it was based, as I understand it, that package was based on share price increasing.
But it is, and revenue they've never increasing. Paid a dividend.
I don't know, you know, but their stock value went up.
Okay.
That was the term of the deal. The shareholders voted for it. I get it.
But there have been all kinds of people, many people in the last several years that have had stocks run up, had these kinds of a package, then something happened to the company. The stocks went all the way down. The guy kept his dough and nobody else got anything. I'm not going to say that's what's happening to Tesla. But my question is, This is the world's simplest rule, is my point. And yet, how we're in this huge discussion about people being charged when they didn't do stuff. And you're right.
So I don't know. I don't know the timing. I don't know the details. But to go to your question, based on the way that the federal government has been weaponized against Trump and against the people who support Trump, you're going to see for a while until he gets in there and starts really cleaning house. Pardon me?
Really cleaning house. Okay. No, so the flip side
when
of
I
this.
Say cleaning house, I mean firing people. I mean removing people.
So the flip side of this is I'm going to put Lou in the SEC chair, and somebody says to me, you know, somebody files a report, and you say, you know, how these guys are supposed to file this form, and I have the number here, filed 13-something-something. When they get to 5% and tell people, well, this guy made it to 15. What is Lou going to do? Oh, we can't go after him. There's no friggin' way.
No, first call would be look at the impact. Second call would be what have we done historically with respect to people who do something like this? And then third call would be, you know, run the indictment if in fact it passes those two checks.
It's an interesting question, Lou, because I think it's. See what I'm saying? It's been so well known that I don't think anybody ever ran over it before.
Well, then this will be a good test case. To go back to your question, the Department of Justice has been compromised. The FBI has been compromised. I don't know if you saw Pam Bondi, the AG nominee, yesterday. The fact that you haven't commented on what she looks like makes me think that you didn't.
I saw it.
Right. Right, Greg?
Well, I mean, actually, what the hell?
Pam Bondi?
Hey, I'm not a Robert Redford.
There were a lot better stuff on Twitter with Pete Hegseth. That was a lot funnier.
Yeah. But my comment was on her appearance, not her actual comments. But the comment that
she made
was...
We don't comment on appearances here.
Oh, really? Okay. Since when? anyway, my point is, she made the comment yesterday. They somebody said, "Well, are you going to be, you know, impartial and not, you know, not investigating people, but you're going to be investigating crime?" And she said, "Well, if by that you mean I'm not going to be investigating Catholic churches and people who object at school board meetings, that's not going to be those. You can pretty much be guaranteed of that." It's going to take
those are domestic terrorists. I'm not sure what you're talking about, Lou.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The Catholic Church is promoting is full of domestic terrorists. My point is that there's going to be a period where everything that comes out of those agencies until they get cleaned out is going to
be. What do you mean cleaned out? Take their people out and put my losers in?
Yep, that's exactly what I mean.
My losers are all going to be winners.
Your losers are not going to be prosecuting people politically. Your losers are not going to cut sweetheart deals for guys who are drug addicts with illegal firearms who've evaded, you know, millions in taxes.
We're going to clean all. How can we do
by
this?
By the way, did you see that they're now claiming that Hunter Biden's art products, millions of dollars were of Hunter Biden's art was burned up in the LA fire? Hello, tax deduction. Hello, loss.
I don't know. Can you do that?
I guarantee you.
You can only declare it against income. Where's the income?
It's like casually lost. What do you mean? He's got to offset that. He's got to offset that $10 million from China somehow.
Well, you know, I really don't want. This is kind of what I don't want. Yesterday, my guys on the show, and by the way, this is my group of people that I love more than anybody. Everybody knows that. But the double standard is absolutely scary to me. If I say something wrong on the show, which I do, guys are listening, and I get a tweet right away. Hey, goofball, the guy that wasn't born on the 1st, he was born on the 2nd. Okay, fine, I'll correct myself.
How come you don't get those tweets when I'm talking? Because I know.
Everybody likes you.
Mistakes.
Everybody likes you.
I make hundreds of mistakes.
Lou, you're an attorney. You sound like you're supposed to. Like you're always right. You sound like you're always right, even if you aren't. You sound like you always are. What can I tell you?
So, can I tell you a funny story?
What real quick? How come? You know, and I really hope the guy does a good job. He's my president now too. I've said that 100 times, and I really believe it. How long are we going to have this double standard where I can't say one thing wrong, yet this, whatever he is, will say between now and Monday 100 more times that he's the only guy that's ever been inaugurated with a flag at half-staff? And, Lou, it's not true. Nixon's second term was Truman that was at half-staff. How long can people tweet me and nobody tweets him and say, "You idiot"? It never happened before, because it has.
The entire corporate media establishment is fact-checking Donald Trump and doing a terrible
job. Nobody around him is.
But they're all out there.
Well, it's easy to do. All I did was Google. By the way, anybody else ever had a thing at half mass? Yeah, Nixon's second came right up.
He's a nightmare. I'm with that stuff, and there's going to be lots of people all over him.
Okay,
but in terms of
did you interview with the Bears? And if not, why not?
No, I did not. Let me tell you a funny story based on your comment about the fact that I sound authoritative. I was with friends, and our local HOA had held elections and a couple of years ago, and I'd run for a spot on the board at the request of some people, and I didn't win. And so our friends were talking about this fact, and one of them just said, "You need a better campaign slogan." And I said, "Like what?" And he said, "Like, Lou is right."
God. You heard this slightly off-color joke about the attorneys. I don't know if I told you yesterday. This comes in on this Quora thing. Evidently, some guy, his car breaks down in front of this lady's house, and she's, you know, attractive young lady. And he goes, "Well, I can't get anybody here tonight. I'm going to have to stay the night." Because you can stay the night. And she goes, "But I only got one bed. And you can stay with me, but, you know." And he goes, "That's okay. I'm an honorable attorney, an honorable member of the bar." She goes, "Okay, well, you can sleep with me, but it's okay. I'm an honorable member of the bar." So the next morning, they go down to the chicken coop. And they've got 8 roosters and 3 hens. And the guy goes, what do you need 8 roosters for? She goes, 7 of them are honorable members of the bar. They're useless. They don't do anything like they're supposed to do. Meaning, what was the matter with you last night, you schlump?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, wasn't that funny? But I love it. Those roosters are honorable members of the bar. They don't act like roosters. Have you ever come across that?
Say again?
Have you ever come across that? I'm honorable, but useless?
Yes, I have.
God. Anyway, what's going on with the NIL? What are these people? Are they agents? How are these guys getting these deals? Who's doing all this?
Well, so this is moving pretty quickly. But yes, most of these people that are doing the counseling are definitely agents, typically attorneys who have some expertise in sports law. I don't know how this works out in terms of registration under state law. You know, almost every state has a requirement that you have to register as an agent if you're representing a player with a professional sports team, not necessarily with a college.
Wow.
So I don't know. I haven't seen any cases where somebody's been dragged in front of a state board or sued by a state board for failing to obtain certification. I will say this. The schools are now moving to kill these NIL corporations and move all the fundraising back under the school as a result of this House ruling in California.
Yeah, I think that's the Brady Quinn guys
this spring.
Didn't the Brady Quinn guys give up in South Bend? They're not part of it anymore.
I think they did, and Colorado announced yesterday that it was disbanding its NIL entity and moving all the donations back under the school. Now, NIL corporations to distribute money can still function, but since the schools are going to be allowed to distribute up to $22 million for the first year, up to $22 million in NIL payments, you know, most of the corporate NIL entities are going, we're not going to even try to compete with that. Yeah, we're going to let that go. So the schools are starting to assume control of their fundraising again.
Or no, but they're still not saying they're paying them.
The schools are saying they're paying the athletes.
Oh, so they're now employees? They're not saying that.
Good question. So the schools are going to be responsible for this NIL money now, and they'll be responsible for distributing it under the terms of this lawsuit. And that's why I think you're going to see a semi-pro league here, especially in sports like football and basketball, pretty quickly, because most athletic directors are going, I don't want to mess with this.
Why don't...
By the way,
how
about this Duke Blue Devils in Notre Dame?
What, the basketball?
Yep. Yeah, not football.
Well, the Irish got their ass kicked, didn't they?
I wouldn't say they got their rear end kicked, but it was a good basketball game. But Duke has got a pretty good team right now.
You've got the people from the sponsors, the Under Armours and the Nikes. They're paying the kids out of high school, aren't they?
They got to be really careful about that. But yes, they are making arrangements for paying these. As soon as these guys come out of high school,
they're not big enough to be on a shoe. They're just directing them to the colleges that they sponsor, or what?
I think that's part of it. Sure, the kid who transferred from Georgia, I don't remember his name,
Carson Beck.
Carson Beck. Yeah.
Yeah, Beck. $12 million in NIL.
Now, is that? It can't be 12 of the school's 22. It's got to be coming from somewhere else.
Oh no! This is the House stuff has not happened yet. The House case settle or NIL payments haven't occurred yet. That's not going to get finalized until this spring. So the current NIL system is still in place. That would have paid what's his face Ewers $6 million if he'd left Texas. That system is still in place and will be for a little while longer.
Well, Kevin said at the Hartman last year at Notre Dame, he just showed up kind of as an alleged grad student and just took a few courses, wasn't really in a program or anything. Or was that you that said that, Greg?
No, I think it was Kevin. I don't know about that. We are rapidly approaching the era of football, collegiate football in the 1890s. And if you want to read about Pudge Heffelfinger and some other guys that played back then, who went from school to school on a weekly basis, supposedly enrolled in a class and then took some money and played for the college football team. Mostly Ivy. This was an Ivy League thing, but that you read about that.
Newt Rackney allegedly was making $100,000 a year in endorsements and stuff. So yeah. I wonder if some of that went. I've asked the fifth gear question and of Kevin and the rest of the gang, and I guess nobody really knows, but the NCAA, in a very late attempt to get ahead of the game, evidently is under serious discussion to just give everybody 5 years. And my question for the last several weeks has been, somewhere, some way, if I'm in college for 6 years or 7 years, I'm going to go in front of a judge and I'm going to get to play 6 or 7 years. I mean, who's to say I can only play four? Well, now the NCAA is going to try, it appears to be trying to preempt that by saying you can play five. Now, my question is, Lou, do you think that'll be forward or retro? Now, if it's retro, if Lou Michaels played linebacker at Air Force or any place and didn't think you were good enough for a pro, but you're a pretty damn good linebacker, and now you're in Duke Law School, and all of a sudden it's 5 years, you get down to the coach and say, by the way, I'm here, where's my 100 grand?
Oh, yeah, you could certainly do that.
So you think it'll have to be retro?
I think it'll be retroactive.
So this Beck guy going to, where's he going? He's going to Miami?
Miami, I think, yeah.
No, but, so he probably is talking about 2 years, not one, right?
I guess. I mean, I don't think they anticipated that college was going to be, you know, was going to be a moneymaker for these guys, but I think that's how it's going to go.
I think, Lou, you're going to have guys, you know, I use your name because you were good at this. I think there's going to be guys like Lou Michaels that plays 4 years someplace, or three, or whatever, you know, play as a freshman, goes on to law school, plays three more because you're still in school, and who's telling you can't play? You're going to get paid the whole way, and you're going to say, I'm 25 years old, I've had enough football, I made some dough, I'm going to go be a lawyer. I think you're never even going to think about going to the pros.
Yep. It's a job.
But what's wrong with that? People actually like playing. It's basketball. Yeah. Hell, I'd play till I was 40 if I could.
I think that's going to be part of the brave new world that's opening up here.
I tell you what, if I could have played basketball, which I was not good enough to do, at Notre Dame for 3 years, went to business school there, got to play another 2 years, got paid for it, and then walked out into a nice job, I can't think of heaven like that, Kevin.
Yeah, there's not much downside there.
God, no. I mean, okay, so I'm not playing with the NBA, so what? $200,000 a year, I'm sitting here going to law school in South Bend and got a nice apartment. I can handle this. Right?
All right. So I got to run.
All right, take care of yourself. Have a good week. Oh, by the way, you skiing? Are you guys still snowing?
No,
with the
it's
rest
too
of
cold.
Oh, it's too cold, eh?
Yeah, it's been really cold up there. I mean, people are skiing, but it's pretty brutal.
I skied a couple days where it was below zero. It was tough when I was young.
Yep.
All right, take care, bud. SP Futures down one. NASDAQ Futures up 27. We're pretty much unchanged. Everybody right to Dan? Do we have Mr. Dan?
I'm here, yes.
How are you, buddy? We were talking. You know,
how are you?
We're making a segue from me playing basketball 7 years at Notre Dame, which would never have happened. By the way, I think to play college basketball, don't you have to be able to jump?
I don't think so.
Yeah, well, talk about.
Congratulations to your team.
I'm worried about Monday night, though. I think Ohio State, I've said all along, I thought they had the best team. And now I think the best roster, let's put it that way. And I they don't have as many people hurt. I just hope they're not embarrassed. I mean, Ohio State, I think, is really good. The Irish are, they have great special teams. They're well coached. I just don't think, I think Ohio State's got better players. I mean, how many guys are going to play on Sunday from there, Greg? Like nine? I mean, it's a huge number of guys going to the NFL. And that's usually when you play these big-time games, it's how many guys on each team are going to go to play the NFL that are that good. The Irish had a bunch, and a couple of them are hurt. So what's the spread, nine or something, eight?
I didn't say it.
I think it's eight.
But the score, right? The Notre Dame score, the game was it was a tight score.
Well, I mean, against Penn State, yeah. But they haven't played Ohio State, and only played them a couple of years ago, and I think they lose both of them, or they played a home and away a few years ago. I think they, I don't know if they split or they lost both. I'm not sure. But I mean, I just think Ohio State's got a better roster. We'll see. I mean, A lot of stuff can happen in a football game, right? Especially when you got good special teams.
Absolutely.
I mean, you look at the Penn State game. If the guy doesn't drop the touchdown pass in his gut on Penn State, and the other guy doesn't fall down or cornerback, Penn State wins. I mean, it was that close, right? That game.
Yeah, it's good. It was that close. It was interesting. So interesting week here, huh?
Yeah. What'd you make of yesterday? Was it all the CPI numbers? Because that can turn on a dime. Next month we could do what we could.
I think volatility. You know, there's just a huge amount of volatility and uncertainty, and the market is really reacting strongly in both directions, right? Because earlier in the week we saw a major sell-off on news that was, you know, wasn't even major, and then yesterday I think they were looking for a reason to rally. We've talked about this before, the CPI numbers, it's tough to know how accurate they are or how they truly reflect what's going on in the economy. But the market was looking for an excuse, I think, to rally, and they got it yesterday. I think also getting the ceasefire in the Middle East kind of added to the rally. That was, you know, people are looking for good news, and they got it yesterday. The other thing on top of that, which is really what drove the market, were the bank's earnings coming out, and that's I think better than expected in many cases. I know Citi and then this morning Morgan Stanley beat. So there's a positive sentiment, but that could change today, right, or tomorrow, and that volatility is what we're likely to see, I believe, throughout this year. That I think is likely to continue. That being said, we're seeing higher prices still. So despite the fact that inflation is just the rate of change or the rate of increase of prices, but prices are still high. I mean, oil prices are high, stock prices are high, real estate prices
back
are
up.
High.
What do you think of this oil stuff? Is this a breakout? It looks like it, doesn't it? $80?
It is, and you know, I don't really know how much of that is Middle East related and how much of that is, you know, the thing about oil is there's so many different factors going into the what constitutes the price of oil. But yeah, it is. I think for the time being, it is a breakout. It's you generally see this just prior to the summer. But any prices that go higher are going to be causes for inflation, right? Even if they're commodities. I mean, silver was up quite a bit yesterday. So anything anytime we see higher prices, that to me, that means we're seeing inflation. And that includes stocks, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's one thing that people miss. When stock prices go up, that's also inflation. You know, so it's...
What do you mean? It's a genius who bought it.
Right, exactly. But they're not incorporated into the CPI numbers. So it's, I guess... In an indirect way they are, but they're not directly incorporated. So that, you know, there's a day that had, there was more confidence, and the market wants to see confidence with still, I think, can be a lot of uncertainty right ahead of us next week.
Well, this is, I'm looking at this chart, and Greg's our chart guy, but oil earlier in the year was higher. I mean, it was in the 80s. But now really from late August till last week, we were bouncing down between 67 and 72, basically 73, for really 6-7 months. Then all of a sudden, within like 4 days, we've shot from 75 to 80. Which, you know, like I said earlier in the year, we were over 80, so it's not dramatic. But it certainly, in terms of the last 7 months, you wanted to be long the last week. The rest of the time, you wanted to be home, right? Not doing anything. But it's somewhat of a jump, and I don't know. Supposedly there's some sanctions that we put on Russia that I couldn't really get much of the detail on that. Dan, did you? We did something, but I don't know if it's that dramatic or what it even means. But I mean, some of these sanctions.
Rather indirectly, there's the settlement in the Middle East, I think, has some indirect impact, but I don't think that's the only reason. The demand is higher because of the global economy coming back, so that naturally reaches the demand, and it is a supply demand to a certain degree. It's not entirely supply demand, but as demand picks up, then the simple fact that that people are traveling more and have continued to travel more. Transportation costs, you know, I think there's an upward bias anyways in oil, and actually all of the commodities for that matter, the majority of the commodities, I should say, including...
Well, we still have... how many people... You're my our Northeast guy. How many people in Northeast still heat with heating oil?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean it's been cold as can
few,
be up there,
yeah.
Right?
No, quite a few. It's,
I mean, you don't hear about that anymore. I mean, I haven't heard... Greg, when was the last time you heard somebody mention oil prices regarding heating oil? I mean, but still, Northeast has got a lot of oil heat, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what I grew up on.
It has to be less. It has to be less and less every year, though.
Benji, yeah. So that does impact. Yeah, it definitely impacts consumers there and at the gas pumps. You know, but that's not I don't think that the at least at the gas pumps, I don't think that's as significant. But it does affect the cost of transportation. So if you're in any industry at all that involves transportation, that's going to impact your business. I know a lot of the airlines used to hedge their oil prices, but that, you know, that is definitely changed, I think, recently. So yeah, the upside, you know, upside can be positive if you're invested, but the upside can be negative, you know, for certain industries.
What do you make of just in terms of market fabric? You mentioned a little bit ago that we've had these up moves and down moves. We went, you know, I guess I should remember, but I think during the Obama administration, not saying it's him, he caused it at all, we went, what, did we go 17, 18 months without a 1% move in the market? It was something really long, wasn't it? And now we've got, you know, I mean, yesterday was a 2.5% move. That's, for God's sake, that used to be like, you know, somebody getting assassinated or something, 2.5% move. I guess what I'm saying is, how much of this is just flipping on the news, and how much of it is market fabric? There's no standing orders, and if it goes up, it just flies up. It goes down, it just flies down.
It that could be part of it, and the other thing going along with that where we've seen a lot of volatility is with bonds. So the bond market was up a lot. As bonds go up again when prices come down. Earlier this week, as you know, the 10-year got up, you know, it was at 480, and now it's at 466, 67. So it came down quite a bit yesterday, and that means that the prices go up. If you own the 10-year bond, your prices were up. 30-year got, you know, to 5%. We had talked last week about the 20-year getting over 5%. I mean, there's even shorter bonds. Even the 2-year was up to like 440. And all of those in one day, we saw that amount. We saw 15 basis points or 0.15% drop in yields. So that level of volatility in the bond market, if you will, is been, you know, you haven't seen those kind of drastic changes from day to day. People are really watching the bond market. I think the smart investors are watching the reaction. Again, you talked about it, Chief, and I keep giving you plugs for having talked about the fact we do expect higher long-term rates, and I still think that's the case going forward because I do think the economy is strong. But in terms of investing, again, going back to the same message, stay short, T-bills still look attractive. Long bond, you're going to see a lot of volatility. You get whipsawed. I never heard of day trading, that much day trading that's going on right now with, you know, investing in long bonds and then, you know, based on what news could happen, but you could make a little bit of money doing that. I wouldn't recommend it.
Well, I mean,
really
the interest rates,
the
10-year and even more so the 30, we had a big jump back yesterday, but today we're creeping up a little bit again on the interest rates. It seems to me that the move upward here is it's like the attack of the cockroaches. It's relentless, it appears, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's the direction we're going in. And yesterday was a bit of a bleep with the, you know, with the such a strong stock market, I guess, for one, and more confidence coming in. But the bond market also is a supply and demand. And there's, you know, when there's buying of longer bonds, then the yields actually will come down. So there is a supply demand component to it as well. The talk about the rate cuts, I think, is also interesting. So just the other day, they were talking about we're going to probably see a rate increase in March. And now they're talking about a rate cut in March, possibly. And that, I guess, means that we're going to skip any type of, the Fed is going to skip any type of move or remain on hold in January, which is coming up, last week in January. It is significant at this point, because any decline in short rates is certainly going to be good for stocks, but the upward movement in the longer term rates is not good. It's not good for mortgage rates. It's not good. It has a negative impact, I think, certainly on investment. So there's, you know, I do think we're going to see a steeper yield curve. Thought about something the other day that I really would want to remind the listeners. The stock market anticipates the economy. It's one of the leading factors of economic growth, right?
It's supposed to, for sure.
It's supposed to, traditionally, if you want to go back to the fundamentals. So 9 to 18 months ahead of the market. So we've seen the increase in the equity market, the last 2 years, we've seen pretty significant increase. And that is predicted where we are now with the economy. Earnings are coming out now. And again, like I said, the banks started off earnings this week and they came in better than expected. The tone of the market or the, sort of what people are talking about right now is we expect to see this trend continue with other industries. So as the year goes on, as the earnings reporting season goes on, we're likely to see more positive surprises. And again, that's good for the market.
Can you name me an American who thinks that good bank earnings is good for them?
Yeah, exactly. No, and I think the concern is another thing that, we're talking about is, we're talking about Morgan Stanley, we're talking about the banks, Morgan Stanley reporting this morning, that if you look at, I know Bank of America and most of the major banks, Wells Fargo, if you look at your checking account or your savings account in your bank, they're still paying next to nothing. So they're making money on you when short-term rates are high as they are. And they're paying out nothing to their customers who have checking accounts and even savings accounts. Interactive Brokers, who we use, does pay a lot. They pay the highest rate, I think, on idle cash or basically cash that's sitting in your
account. You have to have a 10,000. We use those guys too. If they're 10,000 minimum, after that, it's like almost 4%.
Yeah, it is about 4%. Yeah. It was even higher. It was closer to 5% not that long ago, like 4.83, I think it got up to at one point. But the banks make money. When short rates are high and you're only getting 0.01% in your checking account, that's the banks make money on that money that's being held there. And we're talking about the Morgan Stanley, they were talking about how the asset management group did really well. I think the fees that advisors charge also, there's been a little bit more scrutiny on that, but the firms like a Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch are really charging quite a bit. They charge double, triple, quadruple what we charge, for example.
Oh yeah, at least double what we charge, not even close.
Yeah, and that is how they make money. I have I had a new client recently that came on, and we were looking at their fees, and they couldn't understand why their advisor was telling them that they were making 6%, and after doing a review of their statements, realized that they were taking 4%, and this wasn't a large account.
Small accounts get buried.
They do get buried, yeah. Absolutely, and they have higher fees. But I would say again, to the listeners, be cautious, because a lot of people talk about, oh yeah, I've been happy with my guy or my person at XYZ, and my first question to people when they come back and say that is, do you know what they're charging you? Because those fees are not always that obvious when you're looking at your statement. And then if they're in mutual funds, you're paying all kinds of fees, and you might even be paying a load, those old traditional load fees on mutual funds, where you're paying up to 4.5% or 5% to get in or on the way out. But that,
Dan, is it, I should know this, because we don't do it, so I guess it's... Are they... For a long time, you couldn't invest in an ETF. Here was the rule, and you're closer to it than me now, probably, even though you got all these tests and so forth. used to be that you couldn't charge a fee to put somebody in a mutual fund because the mutual fund also charged the fee.
That rule is no longer true.
But that rule, I'm saying that rule is no longer true.
I was looking at a Chase statement the other day for some, you know, some clients that are just coming on board, and they were charging their 1% fee on top of the fee for their mutual funds. And I went in and looked at the mutual, like the breakdown of what the fees were.
Was that like about a 5 year ago change?
I think so. I mean, I think I do remember that, but I don't know that it's really been, you know, I've seen, like I said, I've seen them charge both. And what they tell clients is that they're only charging one fee, but then when you look at the fund, it still charges that. Now, it may be that they couldn't put in load funds because load funds are where whoever sells you that mutual fund gets that fee up front. No load funds still have fees, though. They have management fees. They have, you know, you're paying a whole series of fees. And if you add up those fees, they could be easily 1% or 2%.
Because it was an issue with, we charge fees for some of the places we do subcontract work for. We really, most of our people are here at PTI don't pay any fees. We're on programs, and we're not going to double up on commission and fees. When the ETFs first came out, when you had the spider SPYs, there was kind of no issue because I think the spiders, I mean, I knew this because I was on the board when this all happened. They didn't charge a fee, and you might ask yourself, how do the spiders make money if they don't charge a fee? Well, if you have all of the stocks in the S&P 500 and you get an IBM dividend, you're going to give it on the day you get the dividend. All right, so, I mean, I think you know this, Dan, but if not, it's an interesting education piece. You're going to get, but most of the time, other than the last few years, there's interest, you know, people get paid interest, right? So what the, if you have a spider, though, the SPY, State Street Bank accumulates all those dividends over the quarter, essentially puts them in their vault, makes money on it, and gives you the money at the end of the quarter. So their fee is the float on the dividends, which I think you knew this, Dan. But now when you come out with like the QQQs or something like that, there might not be any dividends. So there could actually be a very slight fee in some of these ETFs.
There are fees in the ETFs.
But they're real slight. They're real slight.
Because they are. So it could be 0.08%, you know, on like SPY. I don't know it off the top of my head, but yes, the fees are certainly much lower, and then you also have the
I think it used to be nothing because of the float on the dividends. They were real happy with that. But
they definitely are charging. Yeah. There's definitely a fee to, you know, even Vanguard's ETFs, which I tend to prefer, the VTI, which is the Vanguard Total Stock Index. They still pay you still pay a very small fee, but their cost of managing those ETFs is not that high.
Right.
Eventually, I think AI will probably take over in managing those because it's really just a question of
the transactions. You got to manage it because
there's a transaction cost. Absolutely.
No, but I'm saying if the way it actually works, this is kind of scary. The specialist who has the SPY, and I'm sure there's one guy. He used to be on the Amex. Okay, he's in charge of. I mean, how do you make SPYs? Well, what happens is if you start buying calls in SPY or whatever the person has to do, if you buy a bunch of calls from the guy, he sits there and goes, okay, my hedge is to buy all 500 stocks. He's going to buy all the 500. I mean, he could buy the SPY, but he could also go buy all the 500 stocks, and he delivers those stocks to State Street Bank, and then State Street Bank issues him the spiders.
Right.
So what happens if you keep buying spiders, the whole, like yesterday, I guarantee you, the guy who's a specialist in the spiders is buying every one of those 500 stocks as fast as he can do it, right? Correct?
Yes, that might be a quant model or it could be done.
Well, but I mean, they know their basket, and they go and buy it. And they have to actually get all 500, where if you and I were doing a basket, we probably would have 40 or 50, right? We're not going to do the rest of them. So these guys actually, like last night, I'm thinking the specialist went to State Street Bank and said, here's a boatload of stocks, guys, give me some spiders. And I think they probably created spiders this morning because of the demand. It's sort of counterintuitive, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. And we're talking just about spiders, but yeah, we've talked about other ETFs.
Same thing.
And those tend to charge the ones that are sector spiders. They tend to charge a little bit more. Then there's now actively managed ETFs that are where they charge even more. So the fees have actually gone up since they originally came out, since ETFs originally became popular. And again, for the listeners, the advantage, if you're buying them in an individual account, not a tax-exempt account or a retirement account, but an individual account, is that you don't pay the capital gains distributions that you pay if you were a holder of a mutual fund. So when you're trying to make the decision between buying an index fund that is indexed off the S&P 500, let's say, as a mutual fund versus an ETF, the ETF is a no-brainer. For a buyer or investor, it makes a lot more sense. It's a lot cheaper to buy, and you're basically buying the same thing.
The only real advantage, there's huge advantages of the ETFs, and Dan just went through a couple of them. But if you wanted to buy, like today, for instance, the market's, we're a little bit up here. But if you think we're going to go really up today, if you buy the spider, you're going to get the spider, if you buy it through PTI or someplace, you're going to get your price on the spider. If you put your money into a Vanguard S&P 500 fund, you're going to get the closing price on the day.
Exactly, so if
we're up another 2.5% today, and I'm not predicting that, you're going to get that price, not the price where you call the guy.
They trade like stocks. Yeah. They trade like stocks rather than, and funds only, they're only priced once a day at the end of the day. What happens, again, for the listeners, what happens as you go from an SPY, which would be extremely liquid, and exactly where it's going to trade during the day because you can follow.
Dan, we lose you? We don't know what happened to Dan. Greg, did we lose Dan? Well, the only, until Dan pops back on here, the doesn't mean that mutual fund SPY is a horrible product. Their advantages are there's no real cost to get in. So if somebody were to come to PTI and say, I'm making an account for my son or something, or daughter, and every 2 weeks I'm going to send you guys $100 to put in the market, you can do that in a Vanguard S&P 500 fund for no charge. Where if you're going to try and buy the spiders, we have to accumulate for a while and then actually make a purchase. You could buy one share, I guess, but people don't necessarily. So at the lower end or kind of the stuff where you're dribbling stuff in, the other stuff is better. Greg, do we know what happened to Dan?
No, can you hear me?
Yeah, now just now you came back in.
You
missed the part where I said the advantage that mutual funds have is if you're going to put, $80 a week in for your son or daughter, they'll do that. Where it's kind of hard to do that with the spider if you're buying buying shares and stuff.
Yeah, although you could, you still could set up. Because the prices you're gonna, you could actually do that if you wanted to. What I was starting to get at is just that a lot of the ETFs that have been created over time have more, they charge a little bit more. They're a little bit harder to follow or a little bit harder to track. If you're on your own, unless you're actually watching the price of that ETF during the day, and you can. One thing that I tend to advise people against is buying, high-yield bond ETFs, for example. And yes, you are buying the market again, and it's like buying a mutual fund. But with bonds, as a bond manager, I'll say that it's better to buy individual bonds. It's better to have somebody do that for you, both in terms of cost and also, that we go back to liquidity issue, because you're buying a high yield bond ETF. At some point, if there's issues in the market, it's going to be hard to trade those. So what hasn't happened is, going back, the ETFs have become popular over the last 15 years.
They started in like 97, the spider, 96, 97, somewhere in there.
Yes. And I'd say over the last 15 years, they've become more and more popular. But there is some, and we really haven't seen any major issues with liquidity with ETFs, and that's one of the positives that we've seen. But we haven't really seen any major issues with liquidity in the market in the last 15 years. So the concern that we have is any new product of Wall Street it generally has a time frame where it does very well, and then it doesn't do well. And that could happen with ETFs. If there's massive selling, for example, and again, that'll also impact the individual stocks that are in those ETFs. Bonds, like I said, I would advise against. In general, unless you have a smaller amount of money that you want to invest, then it makes sense. If you're in, you know, if you have a few thousand dollars and you want to put them in, into a short-term bond ETF, that's fine. But if you're dealing with larger sums of money, you know, 50, 100 thousand or more, then you want to put them in individual bonds. It's more cost-effective. From the point of view of somebody managing that, you're certainly not going to be buying, especially with high yield, you're not going to be buying losers, you're only going to be buying the winners. And then, you know, if you're an individual, you can buy the higher quality names rather than buying the whole index or the whole market. So there are certain places where I think it makes sense to buy ETFs, and then there are certain places where it doesn't make sense.
Well, some of them, that's what I'm good at, but our clients want virtually all their stuff to be hedged in some way. So we use options to hedge, whether it's protection, whether it's trying to get more income out of it, whatever it is, it depends on the person. The strategy is matched up to the person, which, first of all, most firms are not going to do that, but we do. And it's a specialized skill set. It's like a skill set. It's like what Dan does when he finds companies that actually will pay your money back. That's a skill set.
Right, exactly.
And it's a lot of it's 90% perspiration, 10% inspiration, like everything else. But
right.
I stay away from the. I think there's more ETFs now than there are stocks, for God's sake, almost. And I stay away from the ones that aren't liquid. And we really zero in on the stuff the spiders accuse, the Russells, and all the little kind of derivatives thereof. The XLV, which is the healthcare piece of the spider, and the XLF, which is the banking part of the spider. And right. once you drop past those, there's not a lot that are all that liquid, Dan. I mean, like you say, I don't know what's going to happen to a triple long, ETF if we ever have a 30% correction. I mean, I, the jury's still out whether that thing's going to survive. In my mind, I'm sure
right.
I'm being a little cynical there, but you and I have seen some of these products that they actually don't work.
Right, exactly. And that's I think, some of the, some of what Wall Street does is that, they create new products and they have, like I said, they have a period of time where they do well. Years ago, I don't know if you remember, there were the Lions, there were convertible bonds, and there were, I think, Lions and Tigers. I know there were different types of securities that were created by Wall Street, and they did do well for a period of time, and then when the market turned, they got hit more because they hadn't really test rode them, if you will. They hadn't put them through a down market, and that's what I'm saying now about ETFs as well. We haven't seen that. But likewise, one of the questions that I ask companies every time, and you can find this in their 10Q, 10K, if you're doing the analytic work on a company, is who owns the, you want to first find out who owns the stock. And then what's happening recently, if you look at the largest holders of the stocks of individual companies, generally at the top, you're going to see BlackRock, you might see Fidelity, you'll see Vanguard, you'll see the big ETF shops, and then you'll see the money managers, the institutional money managers. And that's really important to note, because if a lot of the money is tied up in ETFs, you have to start asking yourself, what's going to happen if there is... if people pull out of these ETFs. So that's an important question if you're actually talking to a company that you're looking to invest in, or if you want to do some research on your own, find out who owns the stock. And if you see BlackRock at the top of the list and a bunch of other companies that have they're most likely ETFs that they're in. It's not they're not buying them for individual clients or for mutual funds.
Well, Dan, a lot of that, I mean, if you want to find out what can happen, I kind of go back to 2001, right?
Yes.
You had a situation where, and again, this, history can tend to rhyme, but it's not predictive at all, so I'm not giving any kind of a... But the QQQs made it, the QQQs, which is the NASDAQ 100, is now 517. Okay, well, it was 120-something?
Right.
And it had five stocks or six stocks that made up 45% of it, 50% of it, much like today. The stocks, I believe, were Cisco, Oracle, Microsoft, Dell, Intel. What the hell was the other one? It wasn't Apple. Apple was not. Maybe that was it, because I know we had a bunch of that stock from people at the time. And that thing traded 120, and I think, where'd it go down to, 20? It's down 80%, 22 or something?
Initially,
but yes. What ends up happening is if people start selling that, I mean, people now are benefiting. I mean, I guess people can argue one way or the other, but I think they would be wrong. Some of the buoyancy, so we say, in Microsoft, Apple, Google, Meta, those kinds of things, certainly NVIDIA, a lot of the buoyancy is if I have a 401k plan or somebody has a regular retirement IRA here at PTI, and somebody sends us whatever, $2,000 a month, $3,000 a month for the IRA, and it says, I just want to be long Qs or spiders, you know, somebody, sometimes we'll even get a phone call where somebody will say, man, I really like the market, but man, I hate this Microsoft, it's too friggin' high, or this Apple, you know, I don't, they're not selling phone, which they are selling phone, but, you know, they're not selling any phones, I hate that company, by the way, buy me $10,000 worth of Qs. We go, okay.
Right.
Except, yeah. What do you think we're buying? We're buying Apple, hey, Microsoft,
the
NVIDIA.
Market weighting. Yeah, I mean, market weighting is going to be, because they're mostly market weighted, so you're going to have a much larger position in those names.
So you can't get away from. So the same problem is if all of a sudden something goes wrong, interest rates go to, say they go to 8, long-term rate, I'm not predicting that, I got to believe there's going to be some correction in the market. Well, it's going to happen in those stocks. Duh, because people are going to sell their ETFs. And when if you sell the Qs and the specialist has to unload them, what's he going to do? He's going to sell the Apple and NVIDIA. That's what he's got in there, right?
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. There's some firms, and I've looked at some portfolios or some of the positions, if you will, in some new clients' accounts, and there's what we call overlapping, right? So they may be buying whoever, you know, at Merrill Lynch or wherever their money was, they may be buying individual stocks, and they have their list of stocks at Merrill or wherever, the Fidelity that they buy. And then they're also buying their funds on top of that, which might be, they might be buying a fund that also has, let's say, the Big Five, the Mag 7 in them. And then they may also be buying the ETFs. So I've seen situations where they own the fund, a fund, an ETF, and the individual stock.
Well, how many people think Apple is a core holding? I mean, all kinds of people. When I was doing some subcontract consulting work for one firm, Apple was by far their biggest holding. So I was very conscious of whenever I put people's money in there in the queues, I'm buying more Apple.
Right. And I think some people don't realize that that's when they see an ETF or a fund in there on top of individual stocks, that they have a much larger position than what that individual stock position is.
Especially
with the Apples and the Amazons and the, you know, the Googles and the Metas, right? You're gonna have much more concentration, if you will, in those names than you're even aware of.
And it's hard. People are not in. If you have this conversation with, say, a doctor, they're not going to necessarily understand what you and I are talking about. But then again, you wouldn't want you and me taking out somebody's appendix either. So it's a different a different skill set. We're not trying to be, demeaning to anybody. We're absolutely not doing that. But a lot of times, somebody will say, "Well, okay, here's like my investment account. Here's my retirement account." And I'll say, "Well, okay, but do you really want to buy in here? Or would you? Let's look at the whole thing." No.
Right.
In their mind, it's separate, but in your mind, it's not separate. It's
right.
One
it's
person.
It's all part of the same. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and that's why I think it's good to be able to see the whole picture when you're managing clients' portfolios or the retirement accounts. Is that you want to know where the other money is. And one thing that we would look at, for example, is even real estate. So clients who have money in the market, whether it be with individual properties or rentals or whatever, you want that as part of your portfolio. But then, do you really want to be buying necessarily real estate stocks that would invest in or home builders, or, you know, you might want to, you have to kind of look at the whole portfolio to see where their money is allocated across the board. Most people, I would advise that if you have an IRA and you also have a 401k, if you're still working, I would advise to take more of the risk, if you will, as long as you're working, while you're working in your 401k, and have your IRA probably a little less. I mean, you can invest in, you have a lot more choices what you can invest in with IRAs, but make sure, as you're alluding to, Chief, that you have the money that's in your IRA diversified from what you have in your 401k, because there's a, you know, if you're still working and you have these two separate retirement accounts, we want to make sure that you're getting the diversification.
Yeah, I mean, it's not our job to tell people what to do, right? Our job is just refer on one area. But I've had a couple of accounts, and some of them kind of recently, Dan, where the stock side of it was, let's say, somewhat aggressive, you know, pretty aggressive. And then you look at, like, the real estate side or the other investment side, and the real estate is in extremely, where somebody will say, my portfolio, my retirement nest egg is 5 mil, say, or 4 mil. I mean, we're talking about people who have some dough, but if you look at the, you know, 2 mil of it is in some foreign investment or something where you can't even name the company, and another mil is in, you know, real estate and God knows where, I all of a sudden just get this feeling in the back of my neck that I better be real tight with the protection on this million in the stock, right? Because this other stuff's liable to go. You know, I mean, if somebody says, you know, I own 15 six flats and they're all rented and everything else, well, that's not, I don't think that's going to go anywhere, right? It could, but it probably won't. Or if their other investments are, you know, are kind of rock solid, then you sort of have to maneuver that way. You know, if all of a sudden the guy goes, well, I got $5 million, I got $2 million with Dan, I'll say, okay, well, I know that's pretty solid, right? I don't necessarily have to worry about that because I know you are, and you're not putting them in stuff that's going to, not to say you haven't picked a clunk bond, but it's going to be one in a great, you know, a long string of good ones. You know, it's not like you have a, you know, an investment in, you know, God knows what, in, you know, in Yemen or someplace, you know, where I can't even mark the thing, right? So a lot of, I mean, it's all kind of ties together, and that's why I think people sort of need help. I mean, I'm not going to operate on my own appendix.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the most important lessons I learned when I first started almost 40 years ago in the business as a buy-side portfolio manager was to know what you're investing in. You really want to do your homework on what you're invested in, and if somebody is investing your money for you, an advisor, you want to ask them those questions. You know, you want to ask them, you know, what is this foreign stock or what is this real estate investment? You know, I want to have a better understanding. And what you want to understand is not only what you're invested in, but, you know, how liquid it is, how easy it would be to sell it if you needed to. There's, you know, there needs to be full transparency. And I think there needs to be an understanding. Now, it doesn't mean you have to understand every single position in a portfolio, but if you have concentrated positions, you certainly want to understand why and what you own.
Dan, what do you make of I want to talk to you a little bit about the CPI that came out yesterday, because it's the weirdest CPI I ever saw. I don't know how much you listened to me yesterday going through it line by line, but it's, I never saw so many adjustments in a thing. I mean, energy was the actual was minus 0.1, and they got it at positive 2.6. I mean, I don't know where that came from, but and you and I, you know, by definition, are not going to give people tax advice because that's not our job, man. But as I mentioned to you a few times, I'm getting a real lot of concentration issues. There's a lot of companies still, their 401k plan is their stock, and when people leave and they retire, you know, they want to protect it. They want to do something, and like I said, can you name anybody else in the world that even does that, Dan? Other than us, I mean, they will actually take that stuff and say, okay, well, let's get a program. Let's try and protect it. Let's do this. I mean, capital gains right now, I think, is 21%, which isn't very high, you know. If that were to change, let's put it this way, it's only January this year, but if that were to change, say, next year, to 30%, which I don't foresee with anybody, let alone the current administration. If it were to come to 30%, and somebody's still healthy or not looking to die, so they give it to their kids at the new basis, would you say, you know, why don't we? You got $2 million in one stack. Why don't we get rid of a couple hundred thousand of it anyway? 21% is not bad. Or if it were to low, if Trump guys come in and lower it, say they lower it to 15, then I'm going to be a little more aggressive at suggesting. The question you always ask somebody, Dan, is if you walk in with $2 million of, I'll pick one on my screen here, Exxon stock, and I say, boy, that's interesting. How did you end up with that? Well, maybe you got it from your dad, maybe you worked there, whatever it is. There's all kinds of reasons. My first question is, Dan, if you didn't have anything in your portfolio and I just gave you a check for $2 million, would you tell me to immediately turn around, pick up the phone? Well, now you do it through computer, or you could pick up the phone, I guess, and buy me $2 million of Exxon stock. If the answer is no, well, then you sort of have to hedge it. You sort of have to. You're telling me you wouldn't do that. It's not me telling you. I would never hold $2 million worth of Exxon stock. Might be a great buy. But if you're telling me, no, I would never do that again, somehow we have to do something. And now, anticipation of future tax rates, I mean, I really don't want to recommend somebody to sell it at 21% capital gain if Trump's guys are going to drop it to 10. Well, I'll say, hey, I'll hedge it for 11 months, and we'll sell some next year or something. I mean, it becomes part of the game, even though we don't really want it to be, do we?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. But there's a lot of other decisions. There's a lot of other scenarios where, you know, it would make sense, you know, for people to sell it. Maybe, you know, and there has to be some point where they would have to take the, you know, realize that they have to pay taxes on that. Same concept when you're selling a home. And a lot of people, you know, that are in the process of selling homes, they're downsizing generally, they're relocating to retirement areas, and they're trying to make that decision about selling the home and paying the capital gains tax. And it's a similar decision with stocks, you know, if you have a concentrated position. So, and in a sense, when you have a high-priced property, we're talking about some of the properties in Pacific Palisades and places like that, you know, they... Then that decision to sell, it represents a large portion, or you know, a significant portion of your overall net worth. Then it becomes more significant. So it's, but no matter what, you're going to have to pay those capital gains taxes. It's pretty hard to get around that unless it's a rental property, and it was the same thing with stocks. I just believe the diversification, I think, is really important. I always tell people that with investments, you look at today going forward, you don't look at history. That's why so many people say, hey, I've been able to make money in the market. And then you have to decide from today going forward, am I going to be able to continue to make money in the market? There are some people who are considering lightening up in here. They're concerned about the administration. I don't think it's going to be necessarily a negative with the administration for the market, but it may be a negative for certain stocks. So that would be especially true of the concentrated positions. You really have to understand what you own. And if it was a company that you worked for years ago, and while you were working there, you knew exactly what was going on, but now you're away and you might be hearing it from, you know, from people you know that still work there, or you'd certainly be reading up on it. But as time goes on and you get further away from that, it becomes more difficult to have that same level of confidence. And also, I think some people hold on to it to be a team player while they're working there. And then as time goes on, they have different views.
Boy, Dan, there's a couple of companies, and I won't mention their names. There's a couple of companies, if you take your stock out of there and look to sell it while you're still working there, you might as well put a target on your head.
Right. That decision, I think, becomes difficult. You also are generally able to buy it at a discount when you're, you know, and that's one of the advantages, or you're giving the stock at a discount, at a price that you wouldn't be able to buy in the open market. So it makes sense. And then again, when you're trying to make that decision about selling it, you do have to consider the tax implications. But if it's in if it's in your 401k or an IRA, then you're not going to have to be as concerned about that. And it does make sense to diversify.
Well, you know, one of the companies that was really into 401k being all the company stock, or I won't say all, but a lot, a real lot, and it came to a really horrible end, was Bear Stearns. I don't know if you knew that or not.
Okay.
I went to a Economic Club of Chicago dinner with Jim Tyree the day that all fell apart. And the late Jim Tyree, one of the nicest men I ever met. What a brilliant guy. He was head of Mesro. We used to clear through Mesro.
Yeah.
We have two clearing relationships now. I'd much rather be back at Mesro. I mean, they were just terrific people. Did a good job. Clients loved it. I mean, it was spectacular. But anyway, Jimmy's sitting there, and he goes, I have four or five of my best friends work for Bear Stearns. He goes, you know, today they lost their job. They lost all their money in their retirement account.
Oh, right.
And oh, by the way, they live in an area where most of the people live from Bear Stearns. The housing prices, they're all going to be for sale tomorrow. They're going to lose there, too. Talk about a good day, eh? You know, bad stuff can happen. So you have to, you do have to be careful on the concentration stuff. I mean, one of the biggest worries you have about somebody who, you know, since you're very involved in a brokerage firm, and Dan used to do this, is all of a sudden you'll get a client and they have about 15 stacks. A new client, and they'll say, what do you think about this one? What do you think about that one? Well, stocks are priced the way they are. Dan, I'm going to say you're probably way better in this than me, but if you give me a list of 10 stocks, it's just not my skill set. I mean, I'll like the company, you know, whatever, but it doesn't mean the stock's priced right or whatever. It's going to go up, down, or whatever. I can't imagine what would happen if somebody would have wandered in 2007, 2008 and said, ah, geez, what do you think? And had a list of United Airlines, General Motors, Sears, Kmart, Bear Stearns, Citigroup, which had to do some huge reverse. You could have listed 10 stocks, and you'd have said, man, that's a pretty good portfolio. Every one of them went out of business. What if you were that guy that gave that advice? at least I know the spiders aren't going out of business. Dan Janitas is going to be in there. They'll still find 500 PTI, and your outfit will be in there before there's 500, right? I mean, what if you tell somebody a stock's fine, and all of a sudden it goes belly up?
Yeah, we actually do our homework if we inherit stocks. You know, we just make a decision on whether it makes sense to hold them or not. Unless the client is really adamant about holding certain positions, we generally will lighten up, because usually we're receiving those when they're, as a client is approaching retirement, and they want to move more into fixed income, and they want to have a diversified portfolio, but they are looking for our advice. I've been fortunate that hasn't happened very much, but it's, you know, there's, you want to say that, you know, if somebody said here, you know, we're liquidating most of the portfolio, but here are the 15 stocks we want to keep. We tend to prefer to have full discretion on all the accounts. We do some on a non-discretionary basis, but mostly we have full discretion to make those decisions, and we're going to move more into our strategy. So at the very least, we're going to be lightening up in those positions. So that would be the, you know, there haven't been a whole, I can't think of many times where we've been in the situation you're talking about.
I'm just saying, the Chicago area would have been especially hard hit because Sears, United were Chicago companies. I mean, everybody in Chicago had some Sears, for God's sake. I mean, all the old timers. You had Sears, you had a telephone, because when Western Electric was here. These are Chicago kind of legacy stocks. But like I said, you have to be sort of careful, because even in the market's best year, there's clunker losers, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, what we try and do, Dan, is we say, look, pick out the ones you want. Let's get them up to a level, like at least 500 shares or something, that we can hedge. You know, the last thing you want is a string of 100 lots. You know, then.
Right.
But as long as we can hedge them, I mean, you know, that's fine. Hey, what'd you make of this CPI? I know I end up talking too much politics, but the new administration, massive differences between the two people that ran, right? And I was not a fan of either
one. Oh, right.
Yeah. But one thing's for sure, Dan, whoever lands in there, which is going to be Mr. Trump, he may have all the things he wants to do in the world, which you and I would too. We want to make things better. And, you know, I think he's trying to do that. How boxed in do you think the dude is? I think he's really boxed in. The first three quarters of this year, 3 months of this year, deficit's 40% bigger than last year. And some of that's what Biden did, but some of that is his tax stuff too. I mean,
right.
The last 8 years was kind of a combo. One guy lowered taxes, and oh, by the way, spent too much on COVID, The other guy kept spending too much. So the last 8 years was somewhat of a fiscal disaster on both sides, if you look at it that way. I mean, if you take the personalities out of it. So now he wants to lower taxes, get business going, do those kinds of things, which I'm right with him on all that stuff. How the hell is he going to do it? I mean, and I think there's a chance yesterday that's the best CPI number we see for 5 years, and I sure as hell hope I'm wrong. Because I see this money supply creeping up, not only here, but it's really running up in Europe. I don't see prices coming down at all here, Dan. I think they go back up.
No.
I think we're going to get, he's going to end up with a 0.5 or 0.6 number in his first 3 months. Then what's he going to do?
Yeah, no, I would tend to agree with that. The one thing that I say is that I think he would probably do what he could to keep the market afloat, but what he's talking about for policies aren't necessarily going to be, they're going to be more inflationary, which again is going to put upward pressure on rates, which, you know, puts downward pressure on stocks, and eventually also your demand side is going to change. Although, as we talked about, the sort of, you know, you've got the rich to become richer scenario, and the middle class is disappearing, and then you have a lot of people who can't, you know, is still struggling to afford, and they're not necessarily just people who have less income, but they're younger people as well that have challenges breaking into buying homes and, you know, first homes and that sort of thing. So it's, you know, there's certainly going to be some challenges ahead, and getting through these policies, it'll be interesting to see how that happens and how quickly it happens. And what's really interesting is that all begins next week. So we'll see how quickly some of these promises, if you will, or some of these policy changes take place. And it is a concern. There's no question. There's definitely a concern about not only inflation, but how can we sustain such high prices, whether it be in real estate, stocks, food, medical expenses. You know, it kind of goes, you can go all the way down the line, and most prices, I think, are at least still very high.
Well, Dan, what you probably don't want to do, because you want to enjoy yourself, what you don't want to do is move from the CPI number, which when you look at it month after month, it's like, you know,
1 month.
But it's also like, you know, a drop of water on your head.
Right.
And then it's 2 drops, and it's 3 drops. But if you look at the relativity of wages versus, you know, regular stuff, versus when the middle class was, shall we say, there, you know, I'll say late 70s, early 80s, I mean, when the people at Pullman, if you, well, the $20 an hour wage was 40 grand a year, right? That's what made the middle class. Now, I don't think Pullman paid that much. I mean, we were probably paying 18, 19, something like that. But let's say you were in the high 30s. That's without overtime. Or maybe with a little overtime. Maybe they weren't even that much. Yeah, it might be a little high, because I was only making, out of grad school, well, I came in cheap because I was somewhere else, I wasn't making much. But I was maybe making 19, 19.5. So say 20. And then we didn't get overtime. This is 1977, 78. Well, a house was 40, 45, decent house. I mean, not a mansion. A car was 4 for a nice car, new.
Right.
So it was one-fifth of your yearly wage. Well, now a yearly wage for somebody is, let's say they save 39 for an individual. Let's be nice. Let's say it's 45 is a median wage. A house is 400, so it's 10 times.
10 times, right.
And a car, the median price of a new car now is 45 or something. It's even. It's a year's pay for a car. It used to be a quarter of a year's pay for a car. Now, the cars last longer, and, you know, I don't rust as much. I get that part. We're not even on the same page.
Right.
What, not to mention, a Notre Dame education was 25% of 1 year. Now it's double 1 year.
Right. That's a big component.
We can talk about a decent CPI number yesterday. We're not close to getting back to that. We're not even on the same planet.
I agree.
And I don't know how you get there. But I mean, you can't be having somebody have to work 2 hours to afford lunch and say he's doing okay. You know, unless you get like four drinks at lunch like people used to do. We don't really do that. Yeah, nobody does that anymore. But I mean, am I right? We talk about what happened in the middle class. It's right there.
Yeah, absolutely. That's I think that's going to be a big challenge for the new administration going forward.
I think he's putting some people there that have some smarts. As much as I give Musk a bunch of grief, the guy's pretty smart. Can he control all these people? Can he make some progress without getting off the subject and without making enemies? If he can, he has a skill set that other people don't, because he's been in business. He understands how government works or doesn't work, because he's in New York. I mean, so he has a skill set. If he stays focused, I think we might actually benefit. But can he? Do you think he can?
It's going to definitely be a big challenge. No question about it. And there's always going to be winners and losers, you know, in terms of people who benefit and people who have challenges. I mean, we see it from the point of view of the markets, and we've seen that the markets have done extremely well, you know, in the last 4 years. So, I mean, despite COVID, we've had a pretty solid rally the last few years. So it's going to be an interesting period ahead.
Well, Dan, we're going to be with it, and we're going to make sure that our clients, no matter what happens, are okay. Isn't that our
story? No question about it.
SP Futures up 6, NASDAQ Futures up 67. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
All right.
That's all, folks.